Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. While the controversial Enbridge pipeline scheme that would disgorge tar sands bitumen at Kitimat for ocean transshipment to Asia and America created more controversy yesterday in Bella Bella, where the National Energy Board's Joint Review Panel, or JRP, was scheduled to hear depositions from local interveners. The small community on BC's central coast, at the heart of the Great Bear Rainforest, came out in numbers and in full welcoming regalia, but someone on the panel panicked. The review was canceled, the JRP citing, quote, safety concerns. Meanwhile, a statement from the RCMP at the rally by invitation of the Hetzlet First Nation denies there occurred any incident justifying the cancellation. Igmar Lee was at the rally that welcomed the joint review panel. Igmar lives in Shearwater, where the JRP retreated to from Bella Bella, and is a longtime ecology defender at the front lines of efforts to stay the destructive hand of industry, and he works to enlighten the ignorant as to the great dangers facing this corner of the Pacific's ecosystem. Igmar Lee in the first half. And last Friday marked Land Day in the occupied Palestinian territories. That is the annual observance by Palestinians of their dispossession at the hands of Israel. It was marked, as it has routinely been, by Israeli state violence, resulting in death and injury. Like last year's observance, this year's Land Day differed from previous years due to the context of the ongoing Arab Spring and the quickening disintegration of the political status quo in the region. John Elmer is a Canadian journalist who has reported from and lived in occupied Palestine for the last decade. He's back in Canada now, filling his war chest for a return assignment. John Elmer and the increasingly turbulent situation in Palestine in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour to bring us news from the city's streets and beyond. But first, Igmar Lee on fear, loathing, and propaganda along the bumping path of the proposed Enbridge Pipeline's National Energy Board Joint Review Panel. Stick around. Well, welcome back to the program, Igmar.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Good to be back.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you. Of course, now, Igmar, it's blowing a hurricane down here, and I understand you're getting a bit of weather up there, too. And we've heard some other disturbing reports down here about the reception the JRP received at Bella Bella. Now, you were there. What did you see?
Oh, well, we got our whole family all packed up in the boat and headed over to the dock over on Campbell Island. We live on Denny Island, which is about 10-15 minute boat ride away, and we headed over there because we'd been invited, and as had everybody else, to line the road. And just as the Enbridge Joint Review Panel procession was going to arrive at the airport and then drive into town, there was going to be a greeting, and everybody was just standing there with their placards, which a lot of beautiful placards that people had made, saying, you know, stuff like, if not, it's not if, but when, and, you know, all that sort of thing. And mostly kids. There was a huge presence of children from the Bella Bella Band School here, and and the chiefs in their full regalia, and, you know, it was a really boisterous but cheerful, good-natured event, as is everything in Bella Bella. And, you know, the procession went by with an RCMP escort, and, you know, we all just sort of turned around. We had our baby there. He had his anti-Enbridge t-shirt on, and, you know, and then we all just walked back to town with, you know, probably 200 people, I think, I estimate, showed up. So, and then we got to town, and we could see all the chiefs lined up in their full regalia, and they were at the dock and had been welcoming the panelists and the apparently the Enbridge lawyers as well to the feast. There's a big feast planned, and there were speakers and, you know, in the big hall, and, you know, the whole community was in there. And the next thing we heard was that the panelists had very rudely insulted the Haltsik Nation by refusing to participate in the feast, and they just got on the boat and headed over to the Shearwater Corporation facilities. And then we heard that the whole hearings were canceled. And I can't tell you how shocked and outraged, you know, it's just absolutely shocking. People have been preparing for months, all excited about it. The kids are on hunger strike at the school. There's all kinds of community events associated with this thing. And suddenly these the Stephen Harper NEB just pulls the pin. And, you know, I it's just unbelievable. I mean, like you say, the RCMP were baffled. They were there at the airport. They know everybody in the community. They've saw the people that showed up, and there was no. It was just a family event. It was just unbelievable.
Well, Igmar, do we have any idea of who exactly was so threatened and made this call?
Well, you know, my personal belief is that the Stephen Harper PR machine had predetermined by, you know, just that the Haltsik Nation is pretty much unanimously opposed to his pipeline project. I always call it the Stephen Harper pipeline because, you know, heaven forbid if this ugly, dirty oil pipe ever did manage to force its way across against the wishes of British Columbians and start disgorging the dirty oil into our onto tankers into our ocean, and there's an accident. He must go down in history as the most despicable, disgusting prime minister we've ever had. It's just, I can't tell you, like on a daily basis, people here are just gobsmacked by this stupid, crude nature of the government announcements. I mean, it's just one thing after another that they're trying to just derail this process and force this ugly pipeline on us.
Well, what exactly is the role of the Joint Review Panel, and what is it meant to be?
Well, if you look at the National Energy Board, it's just a rubber stamp Stephen Harper factotum. I mean, this National Energy Board historically has virtually never turned down an application for a project of any sort. And if you look at the people that are on the appointees, I mean, you know, it takes a real lowlife to be a shill for a government like the Stephen Harper government. But, you know, just the quality of people that are on that board, real lowlifes. I mean, you know, that they could come in and see this reception from the Haltsik First Nation and then insult them and leave, even after being invited to a feast. I mean, it's like shitting on the doormat. There's a welcome mat there inviting these people to a very significant community event, a very good-natured, very exciting and interesting and beautiful community event. I mean, the hall is just resplendent in First Nations Haltsik art, and there's all the chiefs, and the kids are running around, and you know, and there's just eloquent speakers. Grand Chief of the BC and the Union of BC Indian Chiefs was there. Ed John was there. I mean, and you know, just a incredible behavior that these lowlifes could just insult the community in such a way. It was just horrific.
Well, Igmar, is Bella Bella the first place where we've seen this kind of shutdown of the process?
Yes, it is. And apparently there was much larger turnouts in Comox and everything like that. But I don't know. I mean, I just can't believe it. Like, what we're hearing now is that I guess the public relations factotums down at Stephen Harper Centco must have been working overtime all night, because now they've changed their message from having felt intimidated to now they're saying that they ran into some logistical problems, and they're going to start the hearings at 1 o'clock tomorrow. I don't know how many people that's going to cut out of the feedback loop, but, you know, it's right on schedule with what Harper's saying, is like they're going to curtail the length, they're going to curtail the length of time that that this process takes, so they can rubber stamp it faster. So I think it's just part of this whole scam, and it's just the final nail in the coffin for me as far as any credibility goes over this ridiculous joke. The joint review panel. It is literally a rubber stamp process, clear as a bell. And people here know that that's where it's going. I mean, even at the speeches yesterday, people were saying that, you know, this is we're being polite. The community is a very polite community, and they politely had these people come here because they want to be heard. They want to have their views on the record, and they need to be heard. They were so rudely treated that I was just embarrassed. I'm just ashamed to be a Canadian when I see that type of crap. Like, you know. Well, we put a banner on our dock the other day, and I had to think about the wording, right? And I wanted to say, you know, on guard, protecting Canada's Pacific coast. I can't use the word Canada anymore because I'm so disgusted. You know, frankly, I think that Canadians are pretty stupid, lazy people if they are sitting back and allowing this neocon fascist Harper government to continue to lead our country. It's a shameful and despicable, rotten government.
Well, we've seen, Igmar, that from the Harper government, that they've tried to radicalize, or at least present as radical, any environmental, very mainstream environmental groups. They're going after their funding now, their charitable status, as we've seen over the many years for various other organizations. And it seems now with this kind of stunt, saying, well, you know, there was one report even on Facebook saying that there was somebody saying that there may well have been some kind of gunfire or something. Everything trying to gin things up. I'm wondering if this joke that, as you refer to them, might become a killing joke as they try to push regular legal dissent further and further into the realms of violence and terrorism.
Well, I can assure you, I mean, you can ask anybody in Bella Bella, you know, the 200 people that were up there, there was not a whiff of violence. It was a family event. It was a cheerful and colorful and lots of energy and kids there, and basically the chiefs were also there to greet the other respected chiefs from neighboring First Nations communities around here. You know, as far as the charitable status goes, well, in this day and age, any self-respecting environmentalist would not muzzle themselves and limit their speech so that they could get charitable status. It's an absolute sham, the whole thing. It's just a way to have cooperative, compliant, collaborationist groups. And I think if I was a donor to the environmental movement, the first thing I check is, do these people have charitable status? If so, I move on. I'm only interested in supporting environmental groups that have the freedom to speak their mind and to say their piece. And, you know, if there's groups that are afraid to speak out against the Enbridge pipeline because of their losing their charitable status, then they're just of the same ilk as the Stephen Harper government. And, they should be shunned from the community. It's an embarrassment to have that sort of environmental movement that caters and kowtows to the powers that be.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Gorilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Igmar Lee, and Igmar is a longtime friend of this show and a longtime defender of the environment, especially around British Columbia. Igmar is talking to us tonight from the Great Bear Rainforest at Shearwater on Denny Island. This, ironically enough, Igmar, that is where the this joint review panel retreated from dangerous, I'm using my air quotes here, dangerous Bella Bella, right into your neck of the woods. How are they, first of all, stuck there by this inclement or very, very extreme weather that we've been experiencing off the coast today? And are they mixing well with the locals?
Well, here's the thing. They, like, we live on Denny Island, and there's a distinction there between Shearwater. Shearwater's a corporation that has a cluster of businesses on Denny Island, and we're not Shearwater residents. But the Joint Review Panel did, in fact, go to Shearwater after they retreated from Bella Bella yesterday. And my friends report, and I'm supporting my son Desmond, who's one of the students from the Bella Bella Band School, who's on a hunger strike, a two-day hunger strike right now. So I didn't go to the bar last night, but I'm told by my friends that these Enbridge and JRP folks, the Joint Review panelists, were sitting in the bar, and one of them, even as late as midnight, was sitting in the bar hobnobbing with the locals. That doesn't sound like a very terrified group of people to me. They were told by this, I swear, they must have been told by the Harper government to, you know, just ignore the Hultsik people and find an excuse to cancel the hearings. That's the way I see it.
Well, now they're going to have to carry on to other communities.
Well, you know, as a white man, I'm not as nearly as polite as the Hultsik people, and I just have to throw my hat off for their patience and fortitude, because if it had been me, and they had treated you know, our community as rudely as they did the people at Bella Bella, I would have just told them to fuck off if they go and try to have another hearing you know, tomorrow. Like, after getting everybody all upset, like, I mean, the chiefs had to come over here, like a whole bunch of them, to plead, to say, what the hell's going on? You know, I mean, we're here ready for the hearings, and they had a big long palaver, and then it emerged today that they've changed their message. There was a so-called a logistical problem. They've been delayed for another half day tomorrow. So the people of Bella Bella are losing a day and a half of time to present their case. Very carefully presented interveners, prepared interveners here. They're going to get ripped off for a day and a half of that. And, you know, it's just an unbelievable scam, the whole thing. Well, I'd have just told them to fuck off and go away, and I hope the rest of the communities of BC tell them to fuck off, too.
Well, I'm sure, as you say, that they'll be more polite than that, especially in the First Nations communities. But, I mean, I'm wondering, as you mentioned, other chiefs from other communities came down for this as well. I mean, how many other communities is this traveling show, the review panel, going to go to? And it seems to me that word is going to precede them wherever they go. I mean, this seems like a giant foot in the mouth on their part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. It's the agenda set by the Harper government, the terms of reference, all the rules in there. Like, you know, apparently people are in there trying to say their piece, and these Enbridge lawyers are standing up and saying, order, excuse me, Your Honor, out of order, or whatever. If they do that when I'm saying my piece, and I am signed up as to give my testimony, if one of those Enbridge lawyers interrupts me, I'm just going to tell them to sit the fuck down and shut up. And you just shut up, you rotten shill.
Well, now, what are Enbridge lawyers accompanying? I mean, isn't that sort of a conflict of interest that they'd be accompanying this ostensibly government panel?
The whole thing's just a farcical kangaroo court, Chris. I mean, there's just, you know, and the other thing that we need to remember, and the amount of support. I mean, the Gitgat were there, the Oikino Nation was there, the Newhawk were there, you know, First Nations, the Kitisu Haisreis was there, You know, people had come from all over the coast to support the Haltsik in this, and you know, we all, it just never occurred to us that there'd be any rudeness or anything like that. We just thought we'd, you know, get to hear the interveners. I've been looking forward to, you know, having 3 days over there to experience the thing and hear what people had to say. And just to be shut down like that, it's just outrageous, the whole thing. It's such a scam. And there's one other thing that needs to be mentioned. There was an absolute zero presence of the corporate media, including the CBC, yesterday. I phoned the CBC last night and I just said, shame on the Stephen Harper CBC that was too lazy or could not muster up the funds to send out a reporter to cover the Bella Bella hearings. I mean, CBC purports, and there's daily coverage of Enbridge, and, you know, if somebody farts down at Enbridge headquarters, there's CBCs all over it, you know. But they couldn't even be bothered to send anybody to Bella Bella, and I personally think that's collusion. I think that the whole process colluded with the corporate media and said, look, we've got an idea that we're gonna scuttle this meeting, and we don't want any of you around contradict our claim on the story, right? So it's just shameful and negligent that the corporate media and the CBC have chosen to, you know, just turn a blind eye to this whole process.
Well, you mentioned your son Desmond. He was interviewed, as we were talking off air, by the very CBC. Is this after your call to them? Did they decide to take an interest, or are there only certain types of stories you feel that they're interested in covering?
Well, they're phoning. If you hear their reporters, they're filing their reports from Vancouver. They don't have a clue what's going on up here. They're not on the scene. Anything you hear about the Bella Bella hearings, other than, you know, from the kids. I mean, I was just blown away at the eloquence of the Bella Bella kids that spoke on the radio, including my own son Desmond, who's fasting right now. I mean, the CBC interviewer was saying, "Well, why are you having a famine?" You know, she's that illiterate, she couldn't even recognize that. You know, it's either a hunger strike or a fast. You don't have a famine. But she just repeatedly asked these kids, so why are you on this famine? Why are you on this famine? I mean, just absolute, like, that's the lowlifes that it's down to that's left at CBC, is just these Harper factotums, these Harper shills. The only ones that are left are that Harper hasn't cut from the CBC.
Well, now tell me what you really think, Igmar.
Well, I'm very, very disappointed by the CBC. I mean, it's you know, and you know what? Like, as environmentalists, we used to grovel for corporate media attention. It used to be such a big, important thing. Yeah. You stage a tree sit or something. You make it optically beautiful. You kind of try and interest the corporate media and drag them out. And then they interview you, and they talk to you for 2 minutes, and they pick out the stupidest thing that you said, and that's what makes it to the news for like a 3-second clip, right? Well, we don't worry about the corporate media anymore. That's the new thing these days, is that the progressive media has a far wider readership and far more intelligent and educated and civilized readership, and we don't have to put up with all the bullshit sports and auto sections and all that crap. I mean, like the Vancouver Sun, I'd use it strictly for wrapping fish if the ink wasn't poisonous on it, you know. Just it's an embarrassment to our country, is the post-media news. And, you know, just the people like Peter O'Neill and Barbara Yaffe and all these people are obviously on the Enbridge payroll. Every single article they write for the Vancouver Sun is just a shill for Big Oil, shill for Harper, shill for Enbridge, you know.
Well, now, I guess I'll take a page out of their book and say, well, fair and balanced. And all right, well, maybe they're just terrified, Igmar. Maybe they think, well, we've got this way of life that has developed over these last half century or slightly more. And they're terrified. They live in Toronto and in Vancouver and maybe in Montreal. And they're just doing anything they can to keep the ball rolling, to keep our way of life going and to keep the oil coming, because that's without that, it's what?
Well, look at it this way, Chris. Any British Columbian who's ever been able to take, like, even a day or 2 days or even a couple of hours out of their life to go down to the beach in a secluded wilderness place, as is so easily available in British Columbia, and seen the beauty of the Pacific Ocean, and if they've gone with a little more gumption and come up to the places of this coast that are still wild, they don't go home and start saying we need oil tankers. They understand the importance, the irreplaceableness, the pricelessness, the beauty of this wilderness, and how important it is, and how much more valuable it is than the momentary wealth that might come out of a pipeline that comes out here. I mean, it makes sense to British Columbians, because most British Columbians love our coast, and they know if one of those tankers that were, you know, the size of the Empire State Building, two-thirds the size of the tallest, the tallest building in Vancouver is two-thirds the size of one of these tankers. One of the speakers used that terminology yesterday. You know, the Wall Center in Vancouver is two-thirds the size of one of these super tankers. One super tanker, 10 times the size of the Exxon Valdez. It's not just here, the Great Barrier Rainforest, that will be destroyed. It's the entire Vancouver Island, all of the inlets, all the way down to Vancouver, just slopped in oil. And that's what Stephen Harper's vision for this coast is. It's that serious. And, you know, that's why we have to know, what is the measure of public opinion against this? You see, there's polling, and we all know that, you know, whoever pays the poll gets the answer they want, you know. Mm-hmm. And but we can expect that people who live by polls, such as the Christie Clark government, who live and breathe every day, they're looking at polls. That is the measure of the public opposition to this Enbridge Gateway Stephen Harper pipeline. It's that the BC government is sitting on the fence. They are on the fence because they know that 80% of British Columbians oppose this disgusting, filthy project, and they know that it's political suicide if they utter a peep, much as they'd love to. We know that Christy Clark's just itching. It just wants to, begging Stephen Harper to hold off until after she's elected again, and then she'll open up in BC to big, dirty Alberta oil. But she can't do it because it's political suicide. I mean, thank heavens she's already gone. You know, and all the Gordo rats are jumping off the ship now to an even more despicable ship. But you know, it's pretty clear that she's unelectable.
Well,
and that's a good thing, but you know, that's at least the measure. Is I'm taking it that as long as she's sitting on the fence, they know the numbers.
Well, Igmar, there's a ton more we could go into, and yeah, this is probably the single most vital issue facing this generation living here in this part of the world. And I thank you for your diligence and hard work. Until the next time, then, Igmar.
Yeah, well, one more thing. It's just, if you're not off your ass and helping us stop this dirty oil pipeline, get off your ass and help. We need help. We need everybody out there to stop the Stephen Harper pipeline. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Okay, till the next time, Igmar. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good friend, Igmar. And and what he says is, I'm not even going to contest that. That's absolute. I'm going to take a brief break, and when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Janine, so do stick around for that. Well, welcome back to Gorilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca, of course, around the world on the internet. Joining me now, as oft time she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Well, you can always count on Ingmar to speak his mind. Hey, Chris.
Well, and getting him late, too, because I didn't really have a show going here. And then I got this email at the last minute about what was going on in Bella Bella and we managed to arrange it today. It's just on the fly, so that was really terrific of Ingmar to come on at such late notice.
Absolutely, and especially it's good that he had power still. I heard that there are massive big storms up there, hey, up in that area.
Hey, well, I don't know if these guys are, you know, sort of looking at the bigger picture and saying, well, gee, I wonder if this big oil line, you know, oil pipeline and this, you know, these hurricane winds in April aren't somehow connected.
Yeah, maybe they are, eh? And maybe they just figure, well, I'm old, I'll be dead, who cares, you know. Really, I don't know.
There's always hoping.
Well, it's the young folks that are really coming out against this thing. Like Ingmar said, I mean, they've got this, what's it called, a famine at Bella Bella School.
Yeah, an organized famine by the youngsters. Yeah,
oh, dear.
I'm surprised you didn't say, well, why are you bulimic for this thing? Or,
oh, dear. Well, they are. They're fasting. They started yesterday at 4, and they're going till 4 tomorrow, and April 3rd, that's tomorrow, right? Yeah. And they're looking for people to join. So it's on the Facebook there. So that these are kids, you know, and they're doing this of their own accord. Nobody's forcing them on to do this, like they're getting forced into this pipeline deal. And also over in Vancouver, I was quite happy to find, Chris, Storm the Riding movement that's been going on. It's a weekly thing. They're sort of going every week they're going to do something in the Point Grey riding, which is Christy Clark's riding there. And so they've been doing, you know, education and outreach, knocking on doors, talking to people. They postered Christy Clark's office with all sorts of No Enbridge information. And then they had a big, you know, they joined the rally last Monday. There was a massive big rally in Vancouver. Bill McKibben was there from 350.org and lots of First Nations people, like a couple of thousand people. And so this is university students, mostly, and high school students, and they've got a petition, and it's UBC C350 is that group, so that's pretty cool, I think.
Wow.
And then also, you know, I mean, what's happened just in the last week, right, on Friday, the House of Commons, apparently, the NDP put forward a motion calling for a ban on crude oil tanker traffic off the northern coast of BC here. We've had sort of an informal moratorium for decades, but Nathan Cullen put this forward, and it passed 143 to 138, but they're saying it's non-binding and likely to be ignored by the conservative government that doesn't particularly care for democracy. So that's going on. And then hundreds, about you know, close to 1,000 people apparently in Comox to protest the project on Saturday. So, you know, and then, oh, and the Dogwood Initiative has done a telephone poll asking, do you support or oppose allowing crude oil supertankers through the inside coastal waters of BC? And it was 3-1 against. So, you know, they're really up against it. There's a big rally here in Victoria on April 15th. Unfortunately, I won't be in town for that, darn it. But, yeah, they're inviting people to come to the legislature at 11:30 till 1, and then they're going to walk at 1:30 to Centennial Square. And you know, it's a chance to meet each other and get organized and have workshops and skill development. And then in the evening, there's going to be some documentary films and more opportunity for a discussion.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, and as you know, Ingmar was saying with the discontent in all these different towns across wherever this review panel goes, and up in Comox, you know, there's a huge turnout. And you know, I mean, you'd have to be just entirely blind and oblivious not to realize that the overwhelming sentiment in this province is against having these massive tankers. And, you know, as far as the corporate media, as Ingmar was touching on, you know, Damian Gillis has been doing terrific work on this and great video work. And his website is the Common Sense Canadian, thecanadian.org. And you can go there and get all kinds of background. And there's some frightening stuff. These big tankers, they have to maintain a certain speed to maneuver. maneuver. And you know how it is in the Inside Passage there. They've got to be able to maneuver. This isn't the open ocean. You know, they can't just set the course straight. Although, even when they do that, as the Valdez proved, they can have problems. But, you know, they have to keep a certain speed. And when you think of a day like today, can you imagine a day like today with the winds gusting up to 100 kilometers and more in the Inside Passage, one of these big sail tankers going through there and trying to maintain course? It's a pretty frightening prospect.
Yeah, well, it's sort of amazing that they're actually doing this public process thing anyways. I mean, why are they doing that? You know, it's only the beginning. They're going to Klemtu and Smithers and Terrace and Prince Rupert this month, and then Old Maffitt, I don't even know where that is, somewhere in B.C., and Skidegate and Kitimat Village and Hartley Bay and Prince George. I mean, they're scheduled to be all over the province with these public hearings. You know, this sort of, oh, we're afraid of the protesters, is this the beginning of the end for this process? And why are they doing this in the first place if they don't really care what we think anyways?
Well, I think that there is a concern for what the people think, and I that's why they're doing it. And I think they're trying to say, well, you know, we did something. You know, it's like these phony environmental assessment reviews, like at Fish Lake. You know, it gets knocked down. They say, no, this project's no good. Well, no, that's not good enough. They got to come back. They rejig the numbers. They, you know, change a paragraph here or there and start from zero. And like, we're just going to keep on doing this until we get our way. Well, this is something that, you know, I'm aching to see the report from this, the final report from all of this. But you can know, you know, the Harper government is changing the laws as we sit here, and they're promising the Chinese government that don't worry, you know, that oil production along with the raw logs coming from this province is on its way to China. The boat might be a little slow, but it's on the way. Don't you worry. And all the rest is theater, as far as I can tell.
So is there some legislation that says that they have to go through this process?
Well, now that I don't know. There are environmental assessments. Now, this review panel, though, is something else again, and I don't think that its findings are legally binding in any way. I think it's just a way of, you know, putting a good face on a bad project.
Right, and hoping that they're going to get our approval or whatever, but it's just getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, it's actually pretty cool to see all these indigenous people with all their costumes, like Ingmar said, and the colors and the music. And, you know, I mean, you got to hand it to Enbridge for bringing us all together on this, I guess, right?
Oh, and what he says, too, about the Helsuts and their great hospitality. They you know, put out a welcome mat, as he said, that was spit on. Well, I don't think that's what he said, but... You know, it's amazing to me. You know, it's a whole other world, and you see this in other parts of the world where, you know, people have this great sense of decorum and hospitality, something that's quite alien in our culture, it seems, these days. And these guys just sort of snubbed them and then said, we're not going to talk to you either. You know, I mean, it's incredible to me. And they're trying
that's
to
amazing,
make...
It's amazing, because I think that's what they did 400 years ago,
yeah,
too,
well,
right?
Yeah, well, I guess if we can expect the canon next, then.
So, well, they're nothing if not, you know, patient, as Ingmar says. All right, well, I know you need to get back to your show. I just want to mention there's Earthlings is a documentary about suffering of animals for food, fashion, pets, entertainment, and medical research. Apparently a really good documentary, I've heard, and it's showing April 8th at Camus Books. 7 o'clock. Yeah, so there's lots of other stuff going on in Victoria as well. But thanks so much for covering this issue, Chris.
Well,
this is a big,
okay,
important one.
Well, and you too. And of course, your show, Alternating Thursdays, Winds of Change, right here, 11 a.m. at CFUV and the Victoria Street News, out on the streets in the next month, May, coming fast, no doubt, eh?
Yeah, started working on it, yeah.
Okay, Janine, and of course it's Earthwalk coming up April
21st. 21st, yeah.
Okay, Janine, well, yeah, as Janine says, I'm going to take a brief break and set up for John Elmer. But Janine, you were out at the Piggies over the weekend, entertaining as ever.
The Piggies were great, weren't they? I think, you know, every year it's such an educational event and entertaining as well.
Well, and I talked to Matt, the host, of course, that precedes me here, and Matt was scheduled for one of the skits, but he had a bit of a car crash, as it turns out.
Oh, dear.
Yes, on the way back from Sombrero Beach, and So yeah, that's he couldn't.
Is he
it.
All right?
He seems fine. He seems fine and well. But see, this is it. You never know, especially on the roads out here and out in the west on the west side of the island. It can be pretty pretty treacherous out there. But Matt's well, and the show went on in true theatrical form. And what I'm going to do now is actually play one of the numbers from that show. And this is by Art Farquharson and Naomi. I forgot Naomi's last name. What do you remember, Janine?
Simpson.
Naomi Simpson. They do a pleasurable duet here. And I'll see if I've just got this.
We have a little presentation to make here.
Here's
today.
Art. Till the next time, Janine.
And we have our esteemed orchestra over here on 12 string. Albert is his name.
It is. Albert.
anyway. Maestro, please. All of our bedrooms are gilded and burnished.
With every conceivable luxury furnished.
With Tiffany cauldrons of custom-made candy.
And lead crystal snifters with 100-year brandy.
And all of the wonderful things that we have.
On 12-pouster beds with a view of Manhattan.
A soothing and comforting sight. So why do you people keep asking us how we can sleep at night? We've diamonds the size of split peas on our slippers.
And nightshirts of lace with titanium zippers.
Security guards always lurking here somewhere.
And shrieks who descend with the hint of a nightmare.
We've comative drugs at the snap of a finger.
And classical chamber musicians who linger.
All much to the Sandman's delight. So why do you people keep asking us how we can sleep at night? Fleets holding steady.
And jets on the tarmac all fueled up and ready.
And 100-foot yachts for our White House connections.
And choppers who whisk us in every direction.
Even our house of accountants relaxes.
They've worked it all out so we barely pay taxes.
All our future is peaceful and bright.
So
why do you people keep asking us how we can sleep at night? We've 10 miles of coastline outside Barcelona.
A horse in the Derby, a car at Daytona.
A best of show dog at Westminster, they tell us.
Oh, and a neighbor with $2 billion who's jealous.
An 18-hole golf course in Scotland that's private.
That's driven by Bentley with chauffeur to drive it.
Oh, well.
Okay, well, there's Art, Art Naomi at yesterday's Golden Corporate Piggies Awards. You can, Janine, at her website, Janine Bancroft, blogspot.com, she's got some video of that and audio as well. You can get the whole program, get the whole program there. Well, last Friday, I marked Land Day in the occupied Palestinian territories, and that is the annual observance by Palestinians of their dispossession at the hands of Israel. It was marked, as it has routinely been, by Israeli state violence resulting in death and injury. And like last year's observance, this year's Land Day differed from the previous years due to the context of the ongoing Arab Spring and the quickening disintegration of the political status quo in the region. John Elmer is a Canadian journalist who has reported from and lived in occupied Palestine for the better part of the last decade. He's back in Canada now, filling his war chest for a return visit. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, John. Now, John, for the better part of the last decade, Marwan Barghouti has called an Israeli prison home, and despite his incarceration, Barghouti still figures large in Palestinian politics, and last week he was deemed such a threat from his jail cell that he was chucked into another jail cell, into a solitary jail cell. Now, who is Marwan, and why is he now such a threat to be isolated?
Marwan Barghouti is a Fatah leader who's sort of I guess you could say, probably the most well-respected political figure in the current Palestinian milieu from sort of left to right across the spectrum. He's one of the few sort of unifying figures. He was the leader of the youth movement at the beginning of the Second Intifada and was instrumental in creating the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed wing of the Fatah movement, at the beginning of the Second Intifada. And for that, as you said, 10 years ago, it was 10 years ago this week that Israel launched Operation Defensive Shield, which was in 2002 Israel's largest mechanized invasion since the 1982 war in Lebanon, where they reoccupied the West Bank and, of course, famously carried out the Battle of Jenin at that time, but invaded every major city and reoccupied the West Bank. And at that time, arrested Marwan Barghouti. He sort of understood to be the president in waiting. He's the most legitimate Palestinian figure, sort of untainted by the type of corruption that came with the Arafat era, but still the resistance credentials of that era. And so his statements from prison are very important. The prisoners themselves are very important, the most important aspect of the Palestinian political machine. And from inside prison, and often inside solitary confinement, which they're in and out of, the leadership that's in prison, organize many of the most important political initiatives, including the reconciliation document that is the foundation for the Fatah-Hamas internal strife and reconciliation program, was organized by Fatah and Hamas fighters in and political figures in prison. And still has failed to be implemented on the outside. But Marwan issued a statement on the 10th anniversary of his incarceration, calling for really a sort of a reinvigoration of the Palestinian national movement. He called for unity above all else, of course, saying that the Palestinian struggle or any struggle can't move forward unless it's unified. The internal strife between Fatah and Hamas has been devastating to the Palestinian political scene and political aspirations. And Marwan calling for reconciliation is kind of seen as a shot at Abbas, the Fatah leader that remains president despite the fact that his term ended now. I guess coming up on 4 years ago now ended. But he also called for, he pointedly called to stop the, to stop marketing the illusion that that there's a possibility to end the occupation through negotiations, which is, of course, Abbas's primary raison d'etre, MO, is negotiations, negotiations above all else, despite their failure. And miserable failure that it's clear to see for everybody in Palestine for quite some time, and increasingly even the international diplomatic arena. So that call, which was in a classic resistance communique, begins by acknowledging the leaders of the Palestinian national struggle that were assassinated by Israel, Abu Jihad, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the Hamas leader, Abu Ali Mustafa, PFLP leader assassinated at the beginning of the Intifada, Fatih Shakaki, who founded Islamic Jihad. And it's this kind of gesture towards unity and understanding of the Palestinian cause as a national struggle and not along partisan political lines is a very potent statement from somebody who, as I say, is really the only legitimate leader at this point that can be seen for the Palestinians going forward. And so in some senses, the fate of that resides in the hands of Israel. Some people have said that Marwan Barghouti is kind of a Nelson Mandela-type figure in the Palestinian scene. And one of the explanations for why Marwan Barghouti was arrested, when we know the long history, as I just read out to you, the long history of assassinated leaders, All of the top leadership of every political faction, three, four, five members deep, was assassinated in the Second Intifada. And of course, over the past 60 years, assassination has been a principal part of the Israeli strategy for targeting the political movement. So there are some questions as to why. I mean, this is the level of vulgarity of the assassination campaign, but that people could ask, you know, why wasn't Marwan Barghouti assassinated along with all the other leaders of his ilk that were? And one of the explanations is that, you know, in a sort of peace process type, you know, South African analogy, that Barghouti would come out of prison under a peace agreement and sort of lead the burgeoning Palestinian state. Of course, the level of threat that he poses as a legitimate leader and one who backs a resistance platform is, of course, the reason why he remains in prison, as Mandela did until the very end.
Well, and there was another recent assassination of a leader, and I know I'll butcher this name, but it's Zuhair al-Qaisi, which started off this retaliation of rockets from Gaza into Israeli claimed territory, which of course, you know, sent the back and forth that we've so often seen over the years, that resulted in a few dozen deaths in Gaza. Now, I've heard reports, Richard Silverstein especially writing, that this was a cynical maneuver by the Israeli leadership to have Gaza reply with rocket fire so that they could simply test Iron Dome, their missile defense system. Is there credence to that, do you think, John?
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of the use of assassination during periods of the Western press might call periods of calm, which are never calm. The Israelis mechanized invasions of the West Bank average 100 every week. So you're having dozens a day of invasions happening both in the West Bank and in Gaza. But these periods of relative calm are often broken by assassinations, high-level assassinations that guarantee a response from the militants, and that's what we saw with this latest round of attacks on Gaza. And I think the sort of, I mean, it is cynical to say that it is to test equipment, but even if you don't want to do it directly to say that it was to test their new anti-rocket systems, the sort of premise is what underlines the entire Israeli defense establishment, their world leaders in sort of operative military technology. They're always using, because they're always engaged in constant warfare, they're always able to be at the cutting edge of testing new equipment that then becomes sort of the norm. Of course, the most sort of obvious example in this day and age is their use of unmanned aerial vehicles, which predates the use by the sort of allied forces in Afghanistan and Iraq by 20 years. And so they model themselves. So it's not just a matter of whether this latest example can be sort of cynically pointed to, but rather that the entire underpinning of their military-industrial complex is to be at that cutting operative edge. And the Iron Dome, which is the name of their anti-rocket system, testing it and showing it to the world as effective is, of course, something that goes hand in hand with the ramp up of the sort of beating of the war drums on Iran, because the most natural, in many ways, they're testing this equipment for their own population, because part of the message was to show their own populations that these new anti-rocket systems give them a sort of diplomatic edge, if you will, by showing the world that these rockets can be shot down, because the disposition of a war with Iran is that the response from the region, the odds of it sparking a regional war from Israel's point of view and American military planners' point of view is reasonable. It's entirely possible that in a strike on Iran would result in weeks, if not months, of sustained rocket attacks on the Israeli homeland. And in order to sustain something like that, a campaign like that, it requires the national leadership of that country to prepare the population for that eventuality, because it will need to be sustained for something longer than the state of Israel has been shown on, you know, up till now to do. So the 34-day war in 2006 between Hezbollah and Israel ultimately was Israel that sued for peace in that situation, because the home front was growing weary of living in bomb shelters in the summer heat for days and weeks on end, because the threat of rocket fire from, in this case, from South Lebanon, but in the case of a war with Iran, could be from South Lebanon, from the Gaza Strip, from Syria, from a sustained attack from all of those countries, with a land corridor between Iran and Lebanon for the facilitation of that rocket war between those three countries. So it's a very real possibility that Israel needs to prepare its population for a sustained war. And that's, it can be cynical to say that it was testing military equipment, but in some senses, that's the premise of the entire project.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca around the world on the internet. I'm speaking with John Elmer. John is a Canadian freelance journalist who has lived in and worked from occupied Palestine for the better part of the last 10 years. John, I mean, as well as there's another kind of military readiness, and this is these exercises that Israel is involved in, an exercise with the Americans, NATO, and Greece. Greece being the new partner, Turkey being cut out of the loop for the so-called Noble Dyna war exercises. Israel has been tweaking Turkey's nose quite a lot lately. Why on earth would they want to alienate a NATO ally, and a strong one at that?
Well, I mean, I don't think they do. I think if you look at behind the scenes, the Israeli-Turkish, the diplomatic spats, their populations, they need to preen for their populations a little bit. But behind the scenes, there's a very important military trade between Israel and Turkey that remains. Turkey flies Israeli unmanned area vehicles in its war against Kurdish independence fighters. I think Turkey, there's a fine balance going on with the need for Turkey in the regional sort of dynamic between NATO, Israel, and the U.S. Alliance. And I think sort of people are still, it's still being felt out. And I'm not sure that military exercises, I don't think too much should be put into those military exercises, because when it comes down to it, the role that Turkey plays in the alliance and in the empire's regional designs is crucial. It's a very important player, particularly when you see what's going on its borders with Syria, when you see the role that Turkey plays in Iraq, and the role that's necessitated by Turkish airspace for the regional dynamics of U.S. policing of the region. I think we're going to see more and more cozying up to Turkey. I think you'll see Turkey's role in the alliance expand. And I think the sort of, on the surface of it, of course, there's differences with Israel, and Israel is dying to get into NATO and to get into any exercise that they can, and any meeting that they can. And I think that's something that's important going forward as well.
Well, John, there's always, as ever, there's tons more I'd like to talk about, especially Hannah Shalabi and her fast and her expulsion to Gaza. Gaza is now recognized, I guess, as being, you know, worse than prison. But sadly, we're out of time. John's site is johnelmer.com. John, do you have imminent plans to return?
I do. I'm just taking a well-deserved break, because sometimes it's good to just recharge when you you spend so much time over there, and it's good to recharge a bit.
Well, and to enjoy the nice cool weather as well. I bet you there's something that you miss in the steaming Middle East. Well, thanks a lot, John. Thanks a lot for coming on again, John.
Thanks, Chris. Always
right.
A pleasure.
Okay, then bye-bye for now. And thanks to Igmar Lee and Janine Bancroft too, of course. Now I'm going to bid you to stay tuned, because Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythm and Rhythm. Whoops, and there's a bit of my outtake from the Golden Corporate Piggy Awards. Till the next time.
Why do you people keep asking us how we can sleep at night? Fleets holding steady.
And jets on the tarmac all fueled up and ready.
And 100-foot yachts for our White House connections.
And choppers who whisk us in every direction.
Even our House of Accountants relaxes.
They've worked it all out so we barely pay taxes.
All our future is peaceful and bright. So why do you people keep asking us how we can sleep at night? We've 10 miles of coastline outside Barcelona.
A horse in the Derby, a car at Daytona.
A best of show dog at Westminster, they tell us.
Oh,